want to welcome you to Upcoming Dis and start out by saying I think that we had, up until recently when he passed, a mutual friend. Forry Ackerman used to talk about you.
Oh, Forry, yes, of course.
And I was very fortunate enough to be able to hang with Forry quite a bit, and I know he was very fond of you and talked about you a lot.
Oh, Forry's part of the reason I'm out here.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. I got to write and perform a song for him at his at one of his birthdays back in 2000, and that was such an honor for me. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, no, he had a very wide-ranging influence on a lot of people in the business.
Yeah, he sure did. Well, listen, and speaking of influences, you, like a lot of great directors and filmmakers, got a start in the whole Roger Corman machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted to ask you, going through that specific type of filmmaking, what kind of lessons and tools did you take away from that were so valuable in your career going forward?
Well, they are too many to count.
When you
make a film under those circumstances, you have to lie, cheat, cajole, do anything you can do to get the shot. You work extra hard because it's your first chance and you want it to be as good as it can be. And
mm-hmm.
Roger is rather canny about that. He realized that, you know, people were going to work extra hard for him because this was their break. And even though he had a fiction that he would say, well, you know, no, nobody, you say, Roger, I came in on Sunday. No, nobody comes in on Sunday. Well, he knew we came in on Sunday.
Sure.
Because that's what we had to do to make our Women in Cages movie better than the last guy's Women in Cages movie.
Right. I mean,
there was a lot of competition. And you couldn't help but be influenced by the fact that hanging over your head with the ghostly presences of all the other people who had gone through with Corman School and come out on the other side, you know, acclaimed filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly ended up joining that ranks, without a doubt. And it wasn't too long after that that you did what I consider to be your first and maybe best signature film, and that is The Howling.
Yeah, The Howling came on because Roger always said that, you know, if you're good, you don't have to make more than two pictures for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. I made two pictures for him, and then I moved on to The Howling, which was a much more expensive picture, twice as much money as for the Corman pictures. And again, it was a project where I replaced the director who had left the project and brought in John Sayles to rewrite it, as I have
mm-hmm.
the previous picture I'd done for Roger. And it was one of those movies that was the right movie at the right time. I mean, in 1981, we shot it in 1980, but 1981 was the year of the werewolf. There were a lot of werewolf pictures.
Well, exactly. It was the wonderful year for werewolf because you also have Landis's landmark.
You have Landis's
werewolf
picture. You have Larry Cohen did a picture. You have Wolfen. You have Full Moon High.
Mm-hmm.
It was werewolf year.
But you know, I think what you added to the werewolf genre is the fact that it was the first time that in my memory that werewolves were portrayed more as a community than just a particular monster, and that's carried over, and you see a lot of movies where that's the case today.
Yeah, it's a very self-aware movie, and I think we did break some ground there. I mean, it's also the first movie where the characters already know that werewolves exist and have seen werewolf movies.
Right.
They've never, in all the previous movies, there was always a scene where they would go and say, well, tell me, Doctor, what is a werewolf? And then they'd explain it, and the audience would go, oh, God, that explains it. I know already.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our movie, they just had to turn on TV, and there was Lon Chaney Jr., and we go, oh, yeah, that's right, everybody knows about werewolves.
Sure. Well, I have to say, too, then, moving on from The Howling, one of my favorite movies of yours is, I think, one of the most underrated movies of yours, and that's The Explorers, or Explorers.
Underrated is certainly one word you could use.
What word would you use?
Unfinished is the word that I would use.
You're finished?
Unfinished.
Well, you know, to me, the end of the movie isn't quite like the front of the movie.
Well, the whole second half of the movie isn't quite like the
right.
movie. And, you know, people were accustomed in those days to expecting people, kids, to look up in the sky and be ennobled by heavenly lights that would,
right.
would you know, they would get spiritual value out of aliens and things like that. And I was on a somewhat more humanistic plane. And the kids are all expecting to see how the world transformed and the mysteries of the universe explained.
Mm-hmm.
And all they get is a reflection of themselves from the aliens based on, you know, the pop culture that they've been getting.
Right.
It seemed like a clever idea to me, but I had to admit, the first preview, as soon as the alien said, "What's up, Doc?" and the audience just sat in stone silence, I realized, well, it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think that's where, for me, maybe the movie goes a little straight. But the first half of that film, the dynamics between the kids, the acting you got out of the young actors, and just the whole idea of wonder. I walked away from that with just a beautiful idea of wonder as they
Steven
were developing
Spielberg
it.
Liked it.
What was that?
Steven Spielberg liked it.
Well, yeah, he should, because like I said, it's just it's a marvelous kid movie. It's a marvelous idea of wonder, and I think it really is underrated. I think it's one of the films of yours that when I talk about Joe Dante films with people and I say Explorers, are like, did he do that one, or what? Which one was that one again?
Well, it didn't get a lot of play.
Yeah, good movie, and of course, one that got a tremendous amount of play is Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have to ask you one of the things about Gremlins. It seems that in a lot of your films, you seem to like to deal with cartoons and puppets.
Well, I do like cartoons because I wanted to be a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. But puppets, I've learned to be very wary of puppets in my dealings with them. They're maddening to work with, puppets. I mean, it takes forever to get them to do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, on Gremlins, although we were asking a lot of our puppets, you know, the animatronic business was still kind of new.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done in a very sort of hands-on, primitive way. By the time we got to the sequel, amazing leaps forward had come in terms of the science of it, and we were able to stuff more gears into Gizmo than we were in the first picture. In the first movie, in order to get a close-up of Gizmo, we had to build a giant head.
Right.
Because the little Gizmo, when you got really close to it, you could see all the whirring parts.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
We were constantly sort of making it up on the fly. It's kind of a glorified Muppet movie.
Yeah, but you know what the shameful part is today? I think today, if Gremlins were going to be made today by someone else, it would be a CGI film. And I think that the puppets themselves add a texture to the film that you just don't get out of
the
CGI.
Well, they do, and also the movies are actually, you know, conceived around the limitations of the puppets. I mean, if there was something in the script they couldn't do, then they didn't do that. If there's something we discovered they could do, then we would exploit that. And today, you know, with CGI, you can literally make anything happen that you can imagine if you can pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons there hasn't been another one of those pictures, is because they honestly, there are so many possibilities that they really kind of can't channel it the way we were able to do and say, well, look, this is all they can do. This is what the story's got to be about.
Well, and I think that the idea of controlled mayhem that you managed to do, I can only imagine what it was like behind the set. Some of the large action sequences where the Gremlins just going out of control in the kitchen and destroying
under the set
things.
Is what it was, because we had to build all the sets up on stilts. They were all about 3-4 feet off the ground, and underneath the sets would be this army of puppeteers mm-hmm. with television screens and wires, and they would all be working these mm-hmm. things. And that's why we did almost all of the Gremlin stuff as much as we could after we finished with the actors, because it was so expensive to just keep everybody on, you know, the makeup people and all that stuff, while we were trying to fix broken gears on our puppets.
I can imagine. And, you know, you mentioned television screens, and it's a great segue to a question I've really always wanted to ask you. Is it just my imagination, or do I see a lot of destroyed television screens in Joe Dante films?
There do seem to be quite a few destroyed television screens. Now, I wish I could tell you that this was some conscious effort on my part, sometimes you just go look back at your stuff and you say, there seems to be a pattern here.
So you're not trying to make a statement?
No, I think the statement is made whether I'm trying to make it or not.
Right. Well, and you've worked a lot in television. Throughout your illustrious film career, you haven't been afraid to work in television, going all the way back to like Erie, Indiana, and
no,
how you've done the Masters of Horror.
No, television has always been good to me. And I'm a child of television. I mean, I grew up in the 50s where, you know, the first family to get a TV on the block was the family that had all the kids, you know, going over there to watch the Disneyland show. it was a way of life. It was the world coming into our homes, and also mm-hmm. it was a great conduit to see old movies, because they were always all over the television, and you got to be familiar with pictures that were made before you were born, and, you know, until I got to the age of being able to read Famous Monsters and see pictures of
right.
movies that I hadn't ever thought I would see. You know, that was everything that happened before you were born was kind of like a big void. And it's sort of like that today with today's kids, because even though there are more movies available to see right now than
sure.
there have ever been,
absolutely,
most kids don't know anything about them because they've never been exposed to them.
Yeah,
they don't know some of the great stuff that we did. And we had people like Rory Ackerman to, like, you know, keep reminding us. And,
yes,
you know,
he did.
That we should know who Lon Chaney Sr. was, and we should try to find silent films, even though they didn't have sound. They were still good films. And now I think you have to basically take a film class to get that kind of information.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And one of the things that strikes me about your films as well, and I don't know how conscious this is either, is that you've always struck me as a filmmaker who loves movies. I see a tremendous love of films. I mean, you know, going to matinee and all the William Castle references and the Looney Tunes film and all the wonderful little quick, subtle things. You did the homages to the old films. It seems that in every one of your movies, there's some kind of homage. Gremlins, the George Pal time machine, which is one of my favorite moments in the entire thing. You have a love of films that you expressed out there, and I don't know how conscious it is that every film you try to...
Well, it is conscious, because you try to basically put things in context. You know, when I did The Howling, I there are a lot of references to previous werewolf fiction,
right,
because I wanted to get the idea that, okay, this is where we are now, that's where we've been, mm-hmm, this is where we are now, and this is one way we could go into the future. And to me, that kind of context, it always makes a story more interesting, and brings the viewer, you know, is able to bring some memories and some impressions that they've already had from other films to your film.
Yeah.
And I think it enriches it.
Well, it certainly does, and it certainly comes through in your work. And then looking at your more recent television, too, you go to the Masters of Horror. And now, for some reason to me, Masters of Horror doesn't seem to have quite the same trademark humor that seems prevalent in your films.
Well, the two Masters of Horror I did, mm-hmm, were, one of them was a propagandistic anti-Bush screed.
Right.
Because I was feeling annoyed that no one in the media was making any kind of comment whatsoever about what was going on, uh-huh, in Iraq. And so I had an opportunity to do this program, which they promised we could do whatever we wanted, and I took the opportunity to sound off, basically.
Right.
And then the second one I did was called The Screwfly Solution.
And that's dark.
And it's the darkest thing I ever did.
Absolutely.
It doesn't even have any jokes in it.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's
and it
no
was
humor.
A story that I read in the 70s when I was in New World, and I was kept trying to talk Roger into making it as a movie, and he just said, this is so depressing. I mean, would want to go see this. And he was right. And when I finally did it as a TV show, which I think is the way it should have been done,
mm-hmm,
when it was over, I looked at it and I said, Roger was right. This is really so grim. But I really enjoyed doing it because it was a departure for me.
Did you feel constrained at all by doing it on TV rather than as a film?
No, not at all. That was the great thing about Masters of Horror, was that, you know, the shape of the screen is now the shape of the movies. And
that's true.
The technology has come to a point where you don't shoot differently for television than you do for movies. And it was like a little 60-minute movie.
But what about for the material point of view? Are there still different...
No, there were no... It was Showtime, so they didn't have any... You know, no frontal male nudity, I think, was like was about it. No killing children on screen, maybe, or something like that. But otherwise, I mean, you were really free to do whatever you wanted. And it was a horror show, and people expected gore and violence. And
sure.
So it was okay to be dark.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then you got The Hole, which was a foray into 3D.
Right.
And so I'm wondering what you think of the prevalence of 3D now. It seems that every movie is coming out in 3D, and then these backward conversion processes.
Well, there's 3D, and then there's fake 3D.
Yeah, the conversion jump.
Conversions. They look awful. They're terrible. They're not worth the money. Kids are already catching on, and they're not paying the big bucks to see it in 3D. They're paying to see 2D.
Yeah.
Avengers, I think, is a movie that a lot of people just decided they wanted to see it in 2D, especially when they found out it wasn't shot in 3D. Because having worked in 3D, it's different. You don't
right.
you make a 3D movie a different way than you make a normal movie,
mm-hmm.
And you can't just make a normal movie and then turn it into 3D and have it look like it's as good as it would if you shot it in 3D.
Sure.
I think even James Cameron would tell you that after spending all that time converting Titanic, that
yeah.
he wouldn't have done it a lot of the stuff in it the way he did if he had thought it was going to ever be in 3D.
I have to agree. I'm sure you took an interest in the Piranha. Remake, and my belief is that, at least it looks to me, that was a converted 3D.
Well, that,
it just
that had
work.
To be, because I talked to them before they went. They asked me if I wanted to be in it. It was very nice.
Oh.
But I couldn't do it. And I didn't. I thought they were shooting it locally, and they were shooting it somewhere else. But the thing about that one was that they shot it on video.
Ah.
Because it was on video, and they were in the sun, on the water,
oh.
They realized that 3D was going to be almost impossible to do for real, and that they still wanted to do it in 3D, but they were going to convert it. And I understood why they wanted
yeah.
to do that. But I don't know if the new one, 3DD,
right.
Was actually shot in 3D or if it's converted. I don't know. I try to find out before I go because I don't go to see them in 3D if they're converted.
Yeah, and I don't blame you for that. There certainly is a difference. And I assume The Hole was made in 3D?
The Hole was made in 3D, and we actually won an award at the Venice Film Festival,
yeah.
the first award they ever gave out for a best 3D.
I think that's terrific.
And it's, I believe, coming out this fall.
Is it? That's great. I think that's absolutely terrific because 3D can work if it's used, but too much of the time it's just gimmicky. Too much of the time,
no,
it's...
you can use it. I maybe in the minority, but I think it's an actual storytelling tool, and I think you can tell stories that aren't necessarily throw things at the camera.
Exactly,
but you can actually use it to bring the audience into the frame as if they're watching it, you know, in front of them.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you, what are you working on now?
Well, like everybody in Hollywood, I'm working on 5 or 6 things at the same time for no money, hoping that they'll get funded.
Anything promising?
You know, every time I mention something I'm working on, it falls through. So
oh,
I
okay.
tend to not get into specifics. But I'm hoping that I'll have something that I'll be shooting within a couple of months.
Well, I definitely don't want to jinx you. You know, we were talking about, you know, sequels and remakes like the Piranha stuff that's out. Now, I have to say that of your films, probably the most shamelessly exploited franchise has been The Howling, and they must be up to like 26.
I believe they did 8 sequels and a remake.
There's only that
sort
one?
Of a remake, Howling Reborn, which isn't really a remake because it's a different story.
No, we reviewed that in Upcoming Disc, and it was an incredible disappointment.
Well, you know, the original movie was based on the novel,
right?
And we took a lot of liberties, which I'm not sure that the author was that happy with, but. Then when they made the sequel to that one, which is The Howling Reborn,
right.
Which is The Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, which Philippe Mora directed and Christopher Lee was in.
Mm-hmm.
That one was sort of a riposte to, an attempt to go back to the book and tell the story over
sure.
again. And in several of the sequels, they've gone back to the book and sort of started trying to tell the story over again. But they never tell the story that we told in our movie. They always tell the story that was in the book, which is somewhat different.
Do you have any of your films that you feel like you would like to go back and re-explore in some way?
You mean like Hitchcock did when he remade Man Who Knew Too Much?
Sure.
I have movies that I know I could probably have done better if I had more money and more time, but I'm pretty happy with them. I mean, I'm content to let somebody else take a crack at it.
How about revisiting them as far as sequels for you to do instead of just a studio to do?
The only one that really... the only one that was designed with perhaps a sequel in mind was Interspace,
mm-hmm.
Which I think you can tell at the end of the movie that it's left open for the possibility of a sequel. But when you think about what the plot is and how hard it would be to redo that with those same characters, you'd have to just remake it. I think, and I think it's sort of a riff on Fantastic Voyage, and I think they are remaking Fantastic Voyage.
Yes, they are.
They were going to. And that's a movie that I think that's not my favorite Richard Fleischer movie,
mm-hmm.
And I think that it probably could be improved upon. I think you should try to remake pictures that either weren't done as well as they could have been the first time, or movies that people just didn't know existed and were good stories, and you know they're worth telling again.
Well, what brings me years ago, now I am going back quite a bit. You had been long rumored to be attached to a Creature from the Black Lagoon remake.
I wasn't alone.
Well, yeah, I think John Carpenter was at one time as well, but,
yes,
but I remember
what happened was that in the late 80s, Jack Arnold, who directed the first picture, was still alive, and Universal, you know, contrary to the monolithic impression that people have of movie studios, they liked Jack, and they owed him, and they knew it, and they were going to give him a break by letting him direct this remake, which was written by Nigel Neal, the guy who did the Quatermass picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be produced by John Landis, and I was the backup director
for
Jack, because Jack only had one leg then.
Oh.
And I think the idea was that if there was a hill he couldn't climb, I would do that, or you know,
mm-hmm.
I would just sort of hang around and
and
be supportive. And for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And as happens at Universal constantly, because I know because I had a version of The Mummy that this happened to, that they'll develop the movie, they'll decide not to make it, they'll put it on ice for a little while, and then they'll bring it out again, and they'll attach new people to it.
Yeah.
And they'll do another draft, and they'll spend more money. And so the I think one of the reasons that The Creature from the Black Lagoon has never been remade is because there's so much money against it, and all the scripts that have been written over the years, and the different filmmakers have been attached trying to figure out what to do with it,
mm-hmm.
that maybe it's just sort of not worth it.
So you don't think we'll ever see it then?
I hope we don't, only because I don't know how you could improve on the suit.
That was
always my problem, was that that is maybe the greatest monster suit ever designed.
Yeah.
And every time I've seen them try to change it, like Universal did a live show, I think, recently, last year, with a creature who was singing or something, and they gave him dreadlocks, and it just, like, no, that's not right, that's not how he's supposed to look. I mean, I really don't know how you could improve on the original design.
Well, I think that's true a lot of the old Universal stuff, and especially the old Pierce makeups and the monster.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they shot their wad on Van Helsing. They thought that they were going to be able to have like 12 franchises come out of that, and obviously they didn't. But now I hear that they are thinking of revisiting Van Helsing and trying it again.
Wow. I would like to see a biopic on James Whale. What do you think?
Well, like, it kind of exists.
It does?
Gods and Monsters.
But I was disappointed in Gods and Monsters because it became more of
about the Brendan Fraser character. But still, I mean, that's as close as you're ever going to get to a biopic about James Whale.
I wanted more of the onset, the dealing with people like Jack Pierce, the dealing with the actors. I wanted to see more of the making of, I guess, my favorite horror movies from that day, so...
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't think you should hold your breath for that.
Well, I won't. Well, listen, I've taken up way too much of your time. I am so grateful that you sought us out as well. I'm grateful that you took the time to talk to me and to talk to our audience.
I'm always happy to talk to your audience. And let me plug my website, Travis.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So if you haven't sampled us, please do. We've got 175 trailers and more up with commentaries by filmmakers of all stripes and everything from art house to grindhouse. And
what is the URL for that?
It's trailersmail.com.
Well, I will make sure not only it's on the interview here, I will make sure we put it on the post, and I'll put it on our Facebook and Twitter pages as well.
Great.
Because people need to be exposed to what you're doing, and we hope that there'll be a lot more to come.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot.
No, thank you very much. You have an enjoyable holiday weekend coming up. And again, I appreciate your time and effort, and I got to tell you, you have given me some wonderful moments in the cinema.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.